Accession number 27083, Reel 70.
Sir Henry, you wanted to add a further sentence.
Well, I just wanted to say that I'm not sure that it is valid to take that last remark I made, that there was no hiccup, although I was anxious lest there be one. That in the circumstances, of course, the Chief Defence Staff was a highly experienced, highly competent, war-experienced sailor. And I don't say this critically, but had he been of another service, in view of the nature of the Falklands War, where so much in terms of decision-taking was critically dependent on the Navy, it might have been a different kettle of fish.
And from that, I come to a question which I did raise before, which I don't think you quite managed to touch on, which is a very personal thing and something which I know the sort of thing that journalists on the Daily Express like to ask, so if you'll excuse me for that. When you did go into the Prime Minister on that extraordinary day in the 31st of March in the evening, and you made these very bold statements which you have so clearly indicated in the earlier tapes, were you aware at the time that you personally were, if you liked to use the cliche, making history, that you alone altered the course of prime ministerial thinking that evening?
It didn't occur to me at the time. In retrospect, I suppose, it assumed increased proportions. But at the time, there was what to me appeared as a crisis. It required instant action. It required extensive action involving prime ministerial approval. And that initial action was predominantly for the Navy. That was my job. I was the head of the Navy, and it was as simple as that. I was simply doing my job. You could criticize me and say that I was really doing the job that the acting Chief of the Defence Staff should have been doing.
Why was he not?
Well, I think that's a slightly unkind statement. It's a hypothetical statement because nobody actually did say that. Being an airman and the Air Force couldn't get there and so forth. And I don't think that he just wasn't as acutely involved. And I wouldn't blame him for a moment in not having exercise his right as acting Chief of Defence. I was at great pains, as I've recounted previously, to keep him informed of everything I had done because of his position as acting Chief of Defence Staff, and it would have been very improper if I had not done so. And nor was I, as some critics have said subsequently, ill-disposed critics. One's bound to have a few of theirs. Nor, in any sense, did I regard the impending conflict with the Argentines as a way of escape from the disastrous 81 Defence Review. Simply didn't cross my mind. In retrospect, again, and so spoke to the Defence Secretary. A number of the points that I had made in opposing certain elements of that Defence Review were borne out by the Falklands War. And I could have spent my self-imposed extension walking the corridors of Whitehall saying, "I told you so." But that wouldn't have got me very far down the road. so I didn't do it.
Thank you. My last questions arise out of the programme in which you appeared with Professor John Lambert of London University doing the narration and the presentation. He made a number of statements, and I scribbled them down as he made them, but I just really want to touch on a couple. He said that in the Falklands, the Navy was fighting the war with the wrong ships. Would you agree with that? Would it be possibly that he thought that you, of course, are designed to, the Navy's designed to hunt down Russian submarines and keep the Atlantic convoys open and all the rest of it, but that it's not designed to travel 8,000 miles and undertake a seaborne invasion in the face of air attack from a local country, from a land base that's nearby, I should say?
I would actually contest that remark by him. He may be a very erudite man. I've never met him in the flesh. I watched this program. I don't think it's a valid statement. Enormous effort had been put into trying very hard indeed to maintain what came to be termed a balanced fleet. Balanced against what? Balanced to cover as many eventualities as you could afford, and there lay the key. And that did not mean all, because you couldn't afford it. To adopt some specific antidote to some equally specific scenario, such as, and you've heard me criticize the chief scientific advisor of the day, saying the next war would be fought against the Russians in the Greenland, Iceland, Faroes Gap, and so forth. That was very specific. And it wasn't how it worked out. It was a stupid thing to say. And in no way, had we gone for that, would you have been left with anything approaching a balanced fleet. With a balanced fleet, you conferred on your fleet capability, again, within affordable limits. To that extent, you conferred flexibility to deal with the unknown, to deal with the unexpected. And nobody, and let me emphasize this, nobody has yet predicted the course of the next war correctly yet. And that wisdom hasn't changed over the years. So I dispute that. Quite apart from which, what ships would you have preferred to have had? Well, you would have preferred to have had more carriers, but you didn't, because they'd been paid off. That wasn't your fault. We didn't want to pay them off. That was a matter of rather misplaced affordability, and rather saying that because we were
going back to the mid-60s, going back to Dennis
Healy. Yes, absolutely.
Misplaced affordability.
And misplaced. Well, withdrawing from abroad, and although he never used the phrase little Englanders, but it was an approach towards that, in that direction, and so forth. You couldn't ignore the anti-submarine aspect with the huge submarine threat already posed by the Russians, and so on. So it's You can always be wise after the event and say that if only we had had, and I'm not quite sure where it would have gone on from there. We would have had more Type 22s, which had a better, albeit a closer range, anti-air missile capability. Anything had a better than the gun element of the 21s, but you didn't have the hulls. They didn't exist. And virtually the entire fleet, sooner or later, had been involved.
From what you say, and I wasn't actually going to bring this up, but it seems that the opportunity is here, Do you feel that the decision to scrap the fixed-wing carriers or a fixed-wing carrier capability was probably, in 1967 or whatever it was probably wrong? Would you say that? Even
unequivocally, yes. Absolutely. It was a foolish thing to do. And it wasn't so much could we afford to keep them on as could we afford to let them go, in my judgment. It was a very short-sighted policy. Dennis Healey was an extremely clever man. He was probably, in many ways, he was probably the best defense secretary, even though he was the other side of the political floor that we've had. But he got that one wrong. And he got it. He was known, certainly by any thinking sailor, to have got it wrong, which was why we went through all those machinations of a so-called through-deck cruiser, because the very name, the term carrier, was a dirty name, and so on. And then the through-deck cruisers, because you needed the length of the deck in order to have any reasonable form of takeoff and landing and so forth. And so it went on, and it wasn't until metal was actually being cut with O1, Invincible. I shouldn't have said O1, it gets confused with CVA O1, which of course had completely gone for a ball of chalk. I'll come back to that in a moment. We started to call them ASW carriers, and then they were called V-Stol carriers, I think was the OK phrase, which is precisely what they were. But of course, CVA-01 was a classic example of Dennis Healey's skill, and I use the term deliberately, in putting one element of the debate against another, in this case the Navy against the Air Force. The Air Force cheated. They moved, what was it? They moved GAN, I think it was, 500 miles
on the maps.
On the map, yeah. And never got rumbled. I mean, when the Navy said, look, this is how they're playing it, nobody wanted to hear them. That apart, the Navy was its own worst enemy at the time, because it said, we must have these huge ships, we must have this, we must have that, nothing but the best will do. Any air group less than so many will be meaningless and so forth. And they grossly overcalled the hand. So there were sides to this debate.
Yes.
I think that is enough.
Thank you. My final question before we can proceed with your post-naval career. It's a very simple sort of technical one, and again it arises out of the program that to which I'm referring. Sandy Woodward said almost en passant, really, he said the hunter-killer submarines were controlled from London and not by him.
Mm.
Why was that?
It was largely a matter of communications, and the communications had been set up, well, had dictated the organization. The the strategic nuclear submarines, the Polaris, they had to be controlled from Northwood. I can't remember exactly. I don't think it was in my time. It was immediately after my time, but it was all set for the flag officer submarines to move from Gosport to Northwood for reasons of communications, again. and so on. Now, Sandy Woodward was a submariner himself, and he felt that the task force was the task force, and it included submarines, and therefore he, as a task force or a task group commander, should have been in charge of the submarines. That is a view. It wasn't what happened. I don't think he would be able to seriously complain that having to go through Northwood imposed such delay in terms of changing the instructions or giving approval for some requested action, e.g. the Belgrano, seriously inconvenienced Woodward's forces. But it's a matter of view. If he had not been a submariner, I think that he might not have made that remark.
Thank you. That concludes all the questions I have for you, Sir Henry, on the Falklands. I'm sure that the historians and the specialist researchers listening to this will say, God, why didn't you ask this and why didn't you ask that? But that doesn't really form part of what I'm trying to do in these conversations, as I hope is fairly clear. Shall we proceed, if you're happy, with your vocational fortnight and then your
yes, and then all sorts of odd things I did after,
and all the things that happened after that.
Right. Can they?
Of course. Well, Sir Henry, we'll just have a moment on your. It seems extraordinary that someone of your position and seniority requires a vocational training fortnight. Can you?
Well, it was a. It was a generous act by a generous admiralty. That's the way they played it. Most of my predecessors seem to have gone in for a bricklaying course. I don't know why. They hadn't the slightest intention of laying bricks or anything. I actually had laid quite a number of bricks. You might say not very well, and the line was a bit wriggly, but I knew how to make the mix. I knew how to lay the bricks. I knew exactly what I should be doing. All I needed was a great deal of practice. So I didn't go for that, and I went by arrangement, and I joined up with a chippies class, all EBT people, in Portsmouth Barracks. And I could only do three out of the 6 weeks allocated to the course. And we had, when I first went, we had one short service lieutenant. We had a master at arms, the senior naval policeman in a ship. We had a couple of technicians. We had a naval seaman, and we had an admiral of the fleet. And our instructor was a delightful man who must have been in his advanced 50s, I think, if not 60s. He'd spent most of his life on minesweepers, which originally, of course, had had wooden hulls, and later GRP.
What is GRP?
Glass reinforced plastic. Oh. Anyway, non-magnetic.
Yes.
And he wore a white coat. We all wore, no question of uniform or anything like that, we all wore overalls. I'm not going to go on about this, but this delightful man, he was teaching us how to sharpen a chisel one day, which is pretty fundamental. And he got to a certain point and he laid down his chisel and he said, whatever the number of years was, 40 years I've been at this game. And he paused for effect. We wondered what was coming next. And then he looked up and he said, and I've never made a mistake yet. And we were all sort of ho, 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 because this was boasting some. And then he turned around after a suitable pause and he said, "But by God, I've made some adjustments." Which was a very nice way of putting it. He was very good. They wanted you to do a particular thing. I didn't. I wanted to pick this fellow's brains, and to the extent that I could, his skills, right across the board for shortened 3 weeks. He was excellent. Now, I'd always promised my wife that when I got the sack, which from time to time had appeared imminent, of course, but when I got the sack, I would take her up the Nile. I don't know why I'd picked that. Her father had been, who was a sailor, he'd been stationed in Egypt at the end of the war, and she'd seen a little bit of parts of the Nile, but not the whole thing. In fact, unknown to me, she had changed this. She reckoned that I'd be a bit too close to home and would be got at if we went up the Nile. And as I may have mentioned earlier, when I was commanding the first flotilla, we'd gone round and had a splendid time in Cape Town, where I got to know the mayor very well. We'd fixed it, my wife had fixed it, that we should go to South Africa to, as it were, wash Whitehall out of the system. Not easy to do in a short trip like that. And indeed we did this. We went to South Africa, we flew to Johannesburg, we gave ourselves $40 or so against eventualities in case the flights got delayed. We then had manipulated, telegraphed, tickets in the blue train, which was very impressive in an antediluvian way. I mean, it only traveled about 30 miles an hour, but in great state, and you had your own little tiny bottle of champagne. And it was a scene. It was straight Agatha Christie stuff. And we went down to Cape Town, where we stayed with by then ex-mayor in Cape Town for 2 or 3 days, and we went from there to people that I had got to know during my previous visit out at it was up country. The name is now gone from me, never mind. And then after a week or so there, in a lovely Dutch farmhouse that they had been at great pains to restore to how it had originally been, where closely all the windows opened inwards and things like that. Charming couple, and they looked after us very well. And we then embarked, again by prior arrangement, into a mobile home, a sort of caravan on a motorized caravan thing, which had a couple of bunks and a tiny little cooking area and so on. And we set off along the garden route. And I'm not going to go into this in any detail. And we were going to take 2 months door to door from when we left UK. And so we had the next, instead of wondering what your next job was, the next appointment, who was coming to see you, or you to see them, in 5 minutes' time, and would you make it? It wasn't 5 minutes' time, it was 5 weeks' time that we really should, but it didn't matter much. And so on. It was a wonderful relaxation, and it couldn't have been better. And we spent 3 nights or so in a game park, and that was very rewarding, very good indeed. And then we flew back out. And I was cautious about taking up jobs, because I reckoned I would I could easily take 6 months off it without anything at all, pick up some bits in the garden here and use them very vigorously for doing that, when you'd never really had time before, and so on. But at the end of 6 months, I had to pull myself together and decide what it was I was going to do. Because in practical terms, after a job like that, after what I'd been through, you, at the end of a year or so, for real, you are forgotten. You're out of it. You're out of date. You're out of touch. And vice versa. And so if you want to fix a job, you either do it before you leave, and I was far too busy to do that, or you do it within that first year. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And a man came to me, a retired NO who I knew quite well, and asked me to become president of the British Naval Equipment Society. And I had nothing better to do, and so I drearily said yes. I wasn't terribly impressed with it. And this was a sort of an industrial get-together, and they met once or twice a year, a sort of symposia, that people gave lectures, and it didn't really have very much standing. I was a complete figurehead. I did it for a couple of years and then bowed out. But I went to I'm switching now, to a house, and Dunstan's came about, which was really the first big thing that I had to deal with. And we're in 83, and it was the... It had been, I suppose, the back end of 82 when I went to with my wife to a mutual friend's Sunday lunch party, rather a grand lunch party, in a county, and that sort of thing, not far away, where I was introduced to the then chairman of St. Dunstan's. And what I hadn't known was that he'd apparently turned to his wife afterwards. I don't know how I'd impressed him, but I had apparently impressed him. And so, when I went to 83, Mary and I were asked to go to this chap for lunch on one occasion, much smaller lunch party. At the end of which, he took me to one side and thrust a brochure into my hands and asked if I would consider joining the Council of St. Dunstan's. And I hadn't decided to do anything, so this must have been in the back in the spring of 83. He said, no, take your time, take as long as you like, and so on. And I think this was on a Sunday, and I remember that Sunday evening coming back home. I turned to Mary over a glass of sherry or something, having not really decided to do anything except this British Naval Equipment thing, which I knew was only almost a non-thing. And I said, St. Dunstan's, you know, it's services blind, it's obviously a demonstrably worthwhile thing, and so on. I got to be careful what I say yes to and try and keep it within limits and not say yes to too much. It's so much easier to say yes than no under those conditions. And we mutually agreed that that'd be fine. I could say yes. And so I got on to him and said yes. This, I think I've got the timing wrong. This must have all happened in the autumn of 82. Because he then said that when I actually left the MOD, he would like to take me, having said that I would do this, he would like to take me to St. Dunstan's Homes in Brighton and take me around there and show me what I was in for, which was a sensible thing. Meantime, I've read the brochure, and I looked at the list of those who formed the council, and if only on the basis of seniority, it was pretty clear to me that what he was actually intending, though he didn't say it, was that I should relieve him as chairman. Well, he took me to Brighton, and I still had my Royal Marines driver, and I dropped him off at his house in quite close by in I've forgotten the name of the place again now, but not very many miles away from here, on the way home in the evening, and he asked me in for a glass of whiskey. And over that, he said, "I don't know whether you've twigged it yet," and I had, of course, "but what I really intend is that you should leave me. I've gone very deaf and I can't control meetings." So that was it. And he fully appreciated that I couldn't take on until sometime in 83, and the rest would follow, and it did. And I'm not going to drag you through the 16 long years that I had as chairman of St. Dunstan's,